Everybody, welcome to a new episode of Ben Clymer Presents. We finished last episode with our good friend Jeff Hess talking about vintage Rolex and how things were or were not performing at auction. So we thought it would be kind of a nice segue into a November 2023 auction discussion with my dear friends and colleagues, Mr. Tony Traina over there. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me on your show.
Of course. And Mr. Rich Forden. How are you?
Hey, Ben. Good. How are you?
Good. Are you wearing a double-breasted jacket right now?
I am. I'm a lot more formal than everyone else.
I appreciate that. I respect that greatly.
Yeah. Got to bring it for you.
Indeed. So we are just a few days away from the kickoff of the auction season in November. We had Monaco Legends, which Jeff and I referred to briefly. But now we're kind of into the mainstay of Geneva auctions, which is Phillips, Sotheby's, Christie's, etc., Antiquorum. There's a lot to talk about here. I'm gonna kick it over to Tony to just kind of give us a brief overview of how you're viewing this auction season.
Yeah, it's exciting. There's a lot of huge lots up, both on the independent side and on the vintage side of things. I wrote about the 6062, which is like my favorite vintage Rolex reference. Ben, I know it's one of yours as well, briefly, yeah. Because there are five of them coming up over the next few months. I'm excited to see how all of those perform. A couple of them have already hammered for big numbers, so it's kind of cool to compare and contrast the different models, condition, and then how they're all performing at auction. But beyond vintage, there's a lot of big independent stuff. A couple of private collectors are having single owner sales in Geneva, and then following that in Hong Kong, the beginning of the Oak Collection, which we featured just a year ago or so on Talking Watches when he was in Switzerland, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll be exciting to see some of that stuff coming up for sale. It's the Zaman Collection in Geneva that's kind of kicking off the single owner stuff. The Brando GMT is there, the Dufour Sonnery, things that we saw on the market just in the past few years, really. So it'll be interesting to see how some of those perform. The market, as you and Jeff Hess kind of talked about, is in a significantly different place than it was in 2020 and 2021. So it'll be interesting to contrast how some of that stuff performs as well over the next few weeks here.
I think the interesting thing, and you're totally right, like the market is softer, we'll say, than certainly 2021 and 2020. But I think it's also, it could be stronger than it was in 2019. And I think like there's everything relative to the peak, and then there's everything relative to the pre-COVID world. And I think we're about to see kind of what that means. And I think we'll start with the Brando watch, which is like, there's one of these, right? This is not like there's five Simplicities coming up, which there are, or not like a few Roger Smiths or a few George Daniels watches, which there are. There's one Marlon Brando-owned GMT, which has a Dremel engraving on the back, no bezel, worn in Apocalypse Now, or around Apocalypse Now, by James Stacey. Yeah, James is behind the camera over here. So, I mean, this is one that like is really going to, I think, be a kind of a bellwether for where the world is today. So that watch sold last in 2019, right? Rich, you're fact-checking me, 2019. Phillips Game Changers, so 2019. So that's pre-COVID, right? So before the air quotes hype that so many of us, including myself, refer to. And what did that watch bring in 2019? We're going to look that up right now for everybody.
Rich, you don't know off the top of your head?
I do not. I got the sale. I don't have the number.
I think it was 1.9 million, but I'm going to check. It didn't have that James Stacey provenance three years ago.
So that adds a few million.
Which will add a little bit of money to it, we have to say. This makes for great radio. 1.95 million in 2019 all in. And the estimate this time around is 1 to 2 million Swiss francs.
Right.
It's at Christie's this time. So we'll see. Obviously, they seem to have strong ambitions for it because that's a strong estimate, right? I think it was in excess of $1 million when Phillips had it a few years ago. I don't know. Does it make it less exciting for you as a collector now that we saw it just 4 years ago and here it is again?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think this was a watch that was kind of like, air quotes, lost for many years. And so when you discover something, when we collectively discover something, there is just like an inherent excitement saying, wow, this is the first time this is available to the collector community. Now this watch, we know exactly where it is. We know the name of the person who owns it. We know what it sold for last time. It is less exciting. It doesn't make it any less valuable, right? And I think, you know, the economic situation of the folks that may have wanted this watch between 2019 and 2023 may have changed dramatically, positively or negatively. So maybe all of a sudden there's two guys that didn't have money in 2019 that now all of a sudden do, and now it's a $5 million watch. Or inversely, you know, maybe because the sheen has worn off a little bit of vintage Rolex, maybe it's worth half that. I don't know. And I think that, as I said, will kind of be a bellwether for the vintage Rolex market in some ways.
The one thing I wanted to mention is that now that I'm looking at it, I remember watching that auction in 2019. It was an excruciating like 20 minutes of bidding. it took forever for the thing to sell. I don't know if that's any indication of interest or lack thereof at the high, high end.
Yeah.
The other thing I did want to mention is I'm not sure Rolex was as active at auctions 4 years ago as we've seen them be over the past few sales. I wrote about it when I was in Geneva last cycle, and they bought and won three or four watches, most notably the record-setting Milgauss that sold for like $2 million. So if they decide to get involved, there's no telling how high it could go.
Right. And I think that's kind of the X factor with sports Rolex is if Rolex Geneva is involved, then all of a sudden all bets are off. But it also doesn't create a new market for things like Jeff Hess and I, you know, briefly discussed last week, the idea that like another 6542 or 6541 is worth that kind of money is just not reality, right?
I think you're right. I think this watch doesn't concern me as much as the quantity of, say, Dufours or Daniels in this auction season does. Yeah. This has a lot more going for it outside of the merits of the watch itself.
Yeah.
So looking at this as a marker for vintage Rolex, I think might be a little scary. But in terms of the quantity elsewhere and top line, looking at all the catalogs, I think the main conversations are around how many watches are coming up, how many watches of great quality are coming up, as well as two of the larger collectors over the past 5 to 10 years at auction scenes in these top lots selling off. So that's two less collectors, right?
Yeah. And what is that? And we won't speak about their specific situations, but what does that tell you about like the broader collector base at large? If two guys such as the gentleman, you know, kind of in question here have decided to sell now versus waiting for maybe slightly more stable socio-political economic environment, does that send a signal that maybe now is like we've reached the pinnacle, now we're on our way down and people are trying to sell before we kind of hit a trough? Or is it just that maybe they're just tired of it and they're moving on?
Yeah, I'll probably lean towards the second one there. It seems like these two collectors aren't necessarily those that are trying to time the market right, macro-wise. So it could just be time to sell.
Yeah. Tony, thoughts?
I think that's probably right. I don't want to make a market out of two guys that happen to be selling around the same time.
Yeah.
I'm sure they probably wish they had sold a year and a half ago if they had been thinking about doing it. But, you know, they're at that point in their life. And I think if we're being honest, there probably is not a sign that there's going to be a huge hyperbolic growth in the watch market over the next few years, the way we saw previously, which honestly is probably healthy for the auction market, the watch market more generally. So I don't think they're sitting on it thinking that they're missing out on any returns the way that they may have been over the growth we saw over the past few years.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what there are a lot of, which we've already alluded to. So there are a lot of Simplicities. Our friends at Loop Disc currently have a Simplicity on sale right now, plus all the guys in the auctions. We've got quite a few George Daniels watches, including the only double signed George Daniels Roger Smith watch, which I know is a very special one. We have some Roger Smiths without George Daniels on it. I mean, I won't even get into how many Jorns we have on the market, you know, very air quote special Jorns. What's going on in the independence market?
Can I just ask you a question? Because you used air quotes around special Jorn, and I'm wondering what you meant by that.
The Jorn production numbers is very low, right? And it's just like, I just don't know how many, you know, again, I think that all these markets are, once you get into any small market, you realize how thin the air is, right? And it's like, I had breakfast with somebody recently who realized we own the same watch. You know, we'd known each other online for years and we didn't even know we basically owned the same watch, like the actual same watch. And you realize how small and kind of insular these worlds are. And all of a sudden, there's just a lot of really similar watches on the market. Another example would be Philips Hong Kong having another Recep Recepi CC1 black dial, right? So that's two this year, right? There's 25 of those in the world. So we're talking roughly 10% of them are now for sale in 2023 via Philips, right? So like all of a sudden you realize how small that world is. And when I say air quotes, I just mean that like all these Jorns are special for sure, but like how many people are actually buying these things? And how many people, like if they all knew that, you know, if Rich and I both had 37mm rose gold Simplicities when we were friends, you know, if he knew he was selling his now, I wouldn't want to sell mine right now. And we should talk, and I would sell mine in another platform or something like that. And so I guess I just mean that like that there's a lot of watches that are indeed special, the Jorns included, but they just might not feel that way because there are so many of them available right now.
Yeah, one of the things, I went to physical auctions in Geneva for the first time last spring. One of the things I was noticing, Rich was there as well, you see the same four or five folks bidding on a lot of the high-end lots. Mm-hmm. I don't know if a couple of them were representatives, probably not of the Zaman collection or the Oak collection at this point because they had been looking at selling. But if two of the bigger folks are now out of the market that were dealing in the rarefied air that you're talking about, that could mean something for the market at the super, super high end. Mm-hmm. Talking about Jorn and Debethune, you see people like Watchbox representatives literally bidding in the room for these watches. And that helps create the market there and sustain the market. And I guess I didn't have as much of a grasp of that until I had sort of observed some of these things physically in the room, mm-hmm. Seeing Rolex bid in the room on some of the watches that we were talking about. That said, that's the super high end, and I don't want to make too much about the market as a whole based on, you know, the $1 million watches that I'm a spectator of instead of the stuff that I'm really interested in buying. So that's all to say that the high end is not like super representative of what's happening on the ground, more so where I think there is a lot of excitement around some of this stuff still.
Like what are people excited about?
Well, I was excited about the 6062s, as I mentioned. I liked writing about those. I combed through years of auction reports or auction results on those. You and I were talking about the 2526 white gold that's at Phillips, which I think we're excited about, enamel dial. The most exciting thing, I think, for me at the auctions this season is at the Oak Collection, they've got a 5516, I should say, sorry. It's the AP Perpetual Calendar, one of nine, I think, right? Yep. You went hands-on with this example. It's the same example that came up at Christie's 2015, 2016, I would say.
Sounds right.
So if you dig in the archives of Hodinkee, you can see Ben's hands-on of it from nearly a decade ago at this point, not to age you, Ben. But it's a one of nine watch, and it reminds me of last in the spring, Phillips had a complete calendar chronograph AP from the 40s or 50s. And it was, for me, it was the standout of the season, honestly. It sold for like 750,000 Swiss francs. That is a one of 10 watch. Yeah. And it's like little 33, 34 millimeter thing from the 50s that you wouldn't think much of, but you pick it up in your hands and it's just like such high quality. You just feel the difference of it. And these things are just so, so rare. And that was a complete calendar chronograph. That wasn't even a perpetual. So I think this is a special watch. It sold for about $500,000 when it looks like the Oak Collection bought it in 2015. And I assume it's $1 million-plus watch now.
Yeah. I don't necessarily agree that it's $1 million-plus watch, but we'll save that conversation for another day. This will be off camera where give Tony a good talking to. Just kidding. The 5516 is one of my favorites. It's hand-wound perpetual, one of nine. As I've long expounded, like vintage Vacheron, vintage AP relative to vintage Patek is so special. Quality is exactly the same. Designs are design is subjective, but like really special design from AP and Vacheron, and so much more rare than vintage Patek by like a factor of 10. Plus, in perpetuals, factor of 20. So that's a good call out. That's a great watch for sure. And that's a real connoisseur's watch. You see a wide range of, in the Oak Collection and the other single owners, you get a wide range of stuff that like really is like kind of, holy shit, this is real grail stuff. And then other stuff that's like, oh, okay, like he's into that. That's cool. And which we're all there. Like I've made some very poor decisions in my life, no doubt. But that's a special one. I think, as you mentioned, the 2526 white, which is a first series watch, is really a neat one at Phillips. The idea of white metal enamel dial 2526 is no surprise. I love those. You just don't see them come up for sale often. I'm not sure what number Phillips is quoting in terms of how many they've seen in terms of white gold enamel dial 2526s, but it's not a lot, I can tell you that. I don't remember the last time one has come up at sale. I do remember a platinum watch, but it wasn't a super great example. This looks like a nice, I haven't seen it, but looks like a nice white gold example. That should do really well, assuming that my taste and kind of traditional vintage taste still has some relevance in this world. That's a really neat watch to me. Another one that is also kind of very me is a really early 6239 cream dial. So double Swiss, non-underline, which is interesting based on the serial range. These are just watches that like I've loved for a long time. I continue to love. In some cases, I continue to own. And you just don't see them often. And in both of these cases, Phillips has seemingly, and I say seemingly simply because I haven't seen them yet, seemingly really nice examples. And I think if there is a resurgence in vintage, I think those watches should do extremely well.
Yeah, 25, 26 is in particular, it's important to stress, I think, when you haven't seen them in person, because sometimes you look at these enamel dials up close and there's like spider cracking all over the place. We've been talking about vintage. We kind of dodged the indie question that you started with. I'm curious if there's anything in particular, like you said, there's a plethora of DeFore, Daniels, Jorn. Anything in particular you're excited about, caveated with our conversation earlier?
I mean, excited about? Look, I think the co-signed Daniels Roger Smith watch is special because it represents their relationship, which is really neat. And if you know Roger, which I'm sure you guys do to some degree, like that's a really neat thing for him. It's a really neat thing for me as a fan of that relationship. I'm curious to see, and this is like just purely like, I wouldn't say the speculator in me because I don't own one, but somebody that like watches this stuff closely and watches the market closely, the Recep pink gold black dial, which is coming up in Hong Kong. Like the last time, there are 25 of these in that configuration, 50 in total of the CC1. The last time and only time one sold publicly, I think it sold for 800, something like it's between 700,000 and 900,000, which is just bananas considering the watch retailed for 55, 60, you know, recently, like within the past few years. And, you know, I was speaking with a collector friend of mine, and we were just really curious, like, will that number hold, right? So you have Recep Recepi, who's, I would say not even arguably, he's indisputably the hottest independent watchmaker in the world. This is a very rare watch. There's 25 of them in this configuration. The watch market has changed since the last time one of his watches came up earlier this year. Will it hold? I don't know. My guess is probably yes. But, I mean, that is just an exorbitant amount of money for a very simple watch.
Yeah, I think we're talking about it from the buy side a lot, but on the sourcing side, what I think is interesting, whether it's the Recep or this 2526, I know a white 2526 sold privately within this range in the past year. I think when we look at the breadth of the catalogs and seeing similar things coming back up again, it's easy to see the collector who had that rare thing, such as a Recep, want to put one up for sale because they saw that big number. Now, the question is, does it hold? And my sort of inclination is to ask, like, the specialists and the auction houses have a duty to the consignor to correct, make sure things are timed well.
Right.
But at the same time, given the market right now, they want to put together the best catalog they can. Yep. And is there even a concern that they want to hold that number? And what does that even look like?
I don't know. I mean, I think like that's a question for the consignor for sure. But it's like, I think the question is like, to me and to this gentleman that I'm referring to, it's like, if the hottest, you know, again, I'll use air quotes, which again, doesn't make for great radio. If the hottest watch in the world, which I would put the Recep Recepi CC1 or 2 right up there, if that can't hold in this market, what can? And I'm not saying it can't. Like, it's very likely that it goes for what it did last time. Or, you know, again, we're talking about a many X return on retail, no matter what. But if somebody paid, we'll say $800,000 to split the difference between what I think it went for, and then 6 months later it sells for less than that, what does that mean for this world? Anything? I don't know.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, over the past few years, you and Jeff, again, kind of talked about this. There was so much speculation around watches as investments and people looking for, quote unquote, the next big thing. Jorn being one of the original big things, or DeFore, and Recep became that next big thing. Yeah. And a lot of people were searching for the next one. And maybe that was DeBethune, and maybe that was whatever it was. People
thought Simone Brett.
Simone Brett is one of them now, whoever it is, right? And that drove up a lot of speculation in a lot of these watchmakers, which is fine, I guess, but it drives up the prices. Sometimes it's unwarranted, and I think some of that money is being flushed out of the system right now, which is probably a good thing. And to Rich's earlier point, I think one way to analyze auctions is to look at what's for sale, but another important thing to do is to look at what's not for sale, because that's the stuff that collectors are holding on to because they don't want to sell it no matter the price. So just think about that when you're flipping through the catalogs as well.
Something that really jumped out at me about something that is not for sale this season, you know where I'm headed with this? Think about it. What is like the most discussed / controversial watch of the past 3 years, and what is not for sale?
There's not a lot of Speedmasters around right now.
Also that, but I'm referring to a particular blue dial Nautilus. There's not a single Tiffany blue dial Nautilus for sale this season, I don't think. Is there?
I don't think I saw one. Yeah.
To me, I actually don't know what that says about that market because, like, you know, that watch is the most ridiculous watch of all time, right? It's a $50,000 watch that that would trade for, we'll be conservative and say $2 million, whatever, you know, plus or minus. They've in every season, there's been, since it came out, there's been one or two. and they've all done pretty well. I don't know where the market is now.
Slight downward trend, but yeah.
Of course. But the fact that nobody is selling them now is interesting to me. What do you think that means?
They've all found happy homes, I think.
You think so? They're all where they belong. Yeah, all 170 are with the greatest of collectors in the world for sure. But that was shocking to me that none of those found their way into catalogs this year. Because at worst case scenario, right? We all know what people paid for those. It was $52,000 retail plus tax, whatever. We'll say $56,000-$57,000. Worst case scenario, those are $1.5 million every day of the week. Like that's a pretty hard return to turn down, right?
I guess so, but if you saw the $3 million or the $4 million, whatever it was, maybe you hold out a little bit of hope, Ben. I don't know. I'm an optimistic guy, though.
You sure are. You sure are. Okay, so no Tiffany Nautilus, which I think is genuinely shocking, truly, considering there's 170 of them out there. And then you also have, in many ways, you have the watches that were, air quotes, hypey over the past few years, so... You have some, but not like crazy examples, like steel 5711s, 15202s, and RD watches from AP, things that were really, really hot. And, again, next to impossible to get at retail. We saw a lot of those over the years because they were trading an RD so-and-so from AP is, we'll say, 150 grand. And they were trading at 2.5 times that, or ceramic, right? So the white ceramic, the blue ceramic, these things were impossible to get and trading at many X retail. And we're not seeing a lot of those right now either.
Yeah, I remember, this is slightly skewed, but I remember last spring when Philips did the Royal Oak 50 sale, there were Royal Oaks everywhere in Geneva. You walked out on the sidewalk and you tripped over a Royal Oak. And I remember counting them in the auction catalogs. And I think it was 25 or 30% of all lots were Royal Oaks that spring.
That's too much.
Which was insane. Usually yeah. It's, 8, 12%, let's say. And it's certainly reverted to the mean, more or less Royal Oaks than a year ago, than the 50th anniversary, which is to be expected. But I think, to your point, I think generally I've just seen more variety across the catalogs. There's just a lot of independence, a lot of cool vintage stuff. I mean, we were talking about the Brando at the start, and that was the headline lot when it came to New York in 2019. And it probably won't even be the most expensive Rolex this time around. We saw that Oyster Soto go for 1.7 at Monaco Legends. Yep. There's other Rolex watches across Geneva that might hit a couple million. And that's not even mentioning the independence that might sell for more as well. So there's just a lot more there's a lot more variety, I think, than we saw maybe a year or two ago when it seemed as though auction catalogs were really trying to position themselves as to what they knew to be hot at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the lack of Tiffany Nautiluses or special Royal Oaks an admission that 1 year ago was the peak of that market and we're looking for a new thing? And that's why we have such breadth in these catalogs and
maybe. Maybe. I mean, I'm not going to posit anything here, but I think that I think auction houses in general, and I think collectors are in general are realizing that all these markets are thin. Right. And so it's if somebody wanted to sell a Subscription Jorn or a Duality or a Tiffany Nautilus, some mega watch, the realistic buyer set for any one of those things is, I don't want to say known to most of these experts and dealers, but it's a good percentage of them are known, right? There's that random Chinese billionaire that nobody's ever heard of. There's that random, guy in New York that just doesn't care about the value, but just wants to have the coolest stuff. But if you're in the community, and most buyers are in the community to some degree, everybody knows these people. And I think in many cases, maybe what you're insinuating, Rich, is that these markets are, they're cooked. They're not done by any means. And these are still active, valuable markets. But, maybe it's just we, as you said, maybe we've hit kind of peak Nautilus, peak AP, peak, Jorn.
Yeah, it's more exciting for me. I think looking through the catalogs this season, I, opened up a new tab with more lots than the previous 2 years because for most of that modern and the quote unquote hype stuff, I kind of just scroll by and then look at the numbers after the auctions pass and digest it then. But In terms of what interests me, I mean, this season seems to have more and more.
So what's the one watch you would buy this year if you could?
6264 gold Philips cherry red logo. Very nice cool one. To me. It should be a John Player special or a Lemon Dial the fact that it wasn't swapped over the years to make $1 million watch, mm-hmm. and that now it's presented what we presume to be in an original state with the right dial.
Yeah.
It's in that tight serial range, and it's the consigner or whoever owned that watch admitting that he's okay having a rarer $400,000 watch than a $1.5 million watch if you would swap the dial. And that's not necessarily like all that common. And I think the three of us would disagree with that decision, but all the markers are there for that to be an opportunity. It wasn't done. Mm-hmm. And outside of those dynamics, it's just like the perfect manual wound Daytona to me.
It's a very nice watch. It really is. Tony, what would be your one watch of the season if you could take anything home?
I wrote a lot about the 6062, which is still on my mind. I love the pink gold Stellene one that's at Christie's. It's from the Bethune collection originally, the first time we saw it come up in 2012. It appeared again a few years later, and it's coming to auction again for the third time.
This is Gordon Bethune?
Gordon Bethune, thank you. Yeah, yeah. Also in a Hodinkee article from 2012, actually. So if you really want to dig into the archives, you'll see some really crappy photos of it that I think Ben took.
Bro, I'm right here. Yeah.
So that, you know, if I had an unlimited amount of money, that would probably be the one.
Yeah.
Christie's also has they have a really early date just, which is cool. You know, 4467. It literally has movement number 12 on it, which is just a historical oddity, I think, that kind of no one's mentioning.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I had to pare back the funds a little bit, maybe I'd throw my money at that one.
Yeah, I mean, the Steel 6062, like, I don't want to call it a basic watch because, again, you and I have excellent taste. But it's a watch that I have no shame in saying I lust over. And, you know, seeing Jason Singer's, which you pointed out in that first Talking Watches with him, and then John Goldberger's in the second one, like, these are as good as it gets. I mean, it's a date just case, basically, in steel, but with a triple complication. I love the gold pump pusher as well. The Dufour Grand Sonnerie, which, you know, there's like two sides of me as a collector. One side is like just cool old shit, which is 6062 is, you know. And then there's like, all right, like I know Dufour. I don't know if you guys know this, but I know Dufour. And I have a lot of respect and some understanding of what it takes to do things like that. And it's like, that's about as good as you're going to get from, and like, if independent watchmaking has a future, which we all know it does, how can Dufour's most complicated wristwatch not be something that you just would die to have, you know? I think the big thing on independence that's changing right now, and I should have said this earlier, is you now have retail prices, at least in the case of Roger Smith, at least in the case of Dufour, Debethune-Jorn to a lesser extent, that are now like, they're so far, they're so much higher than they were before, that now it's like the secondhand price versus the primary price are not that far apart. So it's like, and granted, like, you know, you can't just walk in and order a Roger Smith anything. You can't just walk in and order a Simplicity, although, you know, it is conceivable in some way. That, like, I think maybe a lot of people are just like, huh, like, maybe I'll just try to get one directly from the man himself instead of trying to buy one at auction.
I think my reaction is a different, huh? It's hard for me to, without that access, cry for the guy who has access at that original retail price that they're now higher. Mm-hmm. I think these things to me really only exist in this auction world in terms of pricing, mm-hmm. and what the makers, when they do adjust their pricing, when they do change the pricing on these things, it just doesn't affect the larger market for the watch.
Right.
I'm wrong.
Right. No, you, I think you're right. But, you know, it just makes people kind of like mutter a little bit. And the people that own these watches and have supported them, they say, oh, maybe I want another one. When you paid X in, you know, previously, now you're paying 3X. That's a challenging conversation to have for sure. But I do, again, like those, that the world of like Paul Newman buyer, which Jeff Hess and I talked a lot about, or even, you know, Gold Cherry, I think it's a Cherry 6264. Like, those are easy watches to understand to a rich guy that likes watches, right? Like, it's a gold Daytona, it's hand wound, like, you know, what's not to like. The independent stuff is a little bit harder, I think, to understand historically anyway. I think now people are getting it with the rise of Jorn in particular, that like there is a real market for this stuff. So I just don't know, you know, I hear what you're saying, Rich, but I think like there's so many people that like placed orders for those watches when they were like, wow, am I ever going to get my money back on a Roger Smith Series 2 at X? You know, which was just a crazy price, or people thought it was a crazy price at the time. And now, of course, we see that the street value is many times that, you know?
Yeah. And does it take the legs out of a brand when that decision is made, and the X sort of return immediately when you take a delivery of a piece like that? Does that change the appreciation to that guy that you're speaking about who buys these
things? I mean, like, it might not, that statement might not, or that question might not apply only to independents, but like, what if AP, what if you could get an AP 16202 at the street price, which is, I don't even know what it is now. We'll say 80 to 100 grand versus the 25. Like, would you buy it? Assuming that was the watch you wanted, like, would that be compelling to you at a number like that? Or do you look at things as like, hey, like, a 15202, a 16202 is a great watch at $30,000, but at $80,000, it makes no sense.
I don't know. Yeah, I think you get back to the discussion that you and Jeff had on the last episode, which is this rise of investment and how that was a dirty word for a long time. And now it's like the word almost in a lot of cases with certain brands and certain models. But to answer the question, I think if I could have access to that AP, the answer is yes at, you know, retail price. And that seems like such a no-brainer now. But if those things change, then that no longer becomes a no-brainer, obviously.
Right.
There aren't a whole lot of modern watches I'd buy at their secondary market price if it's above retail right now, to be honest. We can debate about where the vintage and independent markets are at, but I think it's pretty clear that these modern mass-produced watches on the secondary market, their value continues to go down. And at the same time, these brands have souped up their manufacturing capabilities in a lot of cases and continue to pump out more watches. And I think that's only going to continue to be the case.
You think the prices will continue to go down for Nautiluses, APs, things like that?
For a little bit. I think they'll stabilize, and maybe they've stabilized around where they are.
Yeah.
But I think they'll continue to. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, Chrono 24, our friends over there, like they came out with a new kind of report, we'll call it, this past week, and I had a look, and I was with Tim, their CEO, last week as well. And it, like, according to them, the prices have stabilized. Like they've dropped. They're 25-30% from peak, mind you. And now they think that things are much more stable than they were before. I mean, I think we've seen things be so tumultuous over the past 6 months that I think we all kind of hope they've stabilized. According to Chrono 24, they have. Again, I'm not gonna put my foot on the scale in one way or another, but that's kind of the way that they're seeing things right now for sure. And I think like there's no question that the brands have been quick to jump on the fact that there's like renewed interest in watches over the past 3 years. And I would like to think that they wouldn't be so foolish to think that like this will last forever. So I would hope that they're smart about distribution with all this stuff. Any closing thoughts or any secret desires or wishes for this upcoming auction season?
I'm hoping for that 6062 to show up in my, maybe a Christmas gift or something.
Mm-hmm. Christmas bonus from Rich.
Something like that.
Yep.
Yeah, from Rich. But besides that, I hope that, I hope that there's no sort of, I think the way in which we covered auctions a lot over the past few years, there was a lot of sort of breathless coverage of headlines and headline lots and big numbers and big auction results and stuff like that. I think because of things that have happened around the auction world over the past couple of years, we've wised up to that and view things with a more critical or more reasonable eye. And I just hope we continue to do that.
Yeah. Rich?
Yeah, I think I'm always looking at the fringes in these kinds of auctions. Like people like Tony cover the headliner lots, and I can kind of focus on more of the secondary level. So I'm interested to see, you know, like what more normal references like vintage Daytonas, vintage Subs, when I see them in good condition. As far as I can tell from photos, not handling these watches in person, I think when you see major outlier results at the end of the sales, you have to go back and figure out like why that was. And was it just two people in the room that got in a fight or what have you? But I'm looking to that sort of middle quality watch as always.
Yeah. So going back to the conversation I had with Jeff on the last episode, like, Where do you see, as somebody who, and for those who don't know, Rich is a VIP advisor, so more on the commercial side of the house, you're dealing with watches in the market all day. Where do you see vintage Rolex? Like, is there an increased demand for it? Are people kind of circling back around, or is it still kind of where it's been over the past 6 months or so, 2 years or so?
I think I would go towards that last one there. The people that want it are still there. The issue of vintage Rolex lately is not a change in price, it's a change in velocity. If you want a great matte dial GMT, it's there for you. But given the tone of the market, you would expect it to be 5 grand less than it was a year ago, and it's just not. Because the holders of those watches don't really pay attention to the rest of the market, in my opinion, as much as like a modern Batman buyer does, or a for talking secondary market values on these modern watches. Mm-hmm. But there's still an interest and a willingness to pay the price when that price is up, but the velocity is down versus, when I say down, I would say 2 years ago.
Interesting. So you're saying vintage Rolex velocity is down from 2 years ago, which was kind of the peak of the contemporary watch world.
Right. I would say so. There was a, when that was all going on, for me at least, I saw people looking to other things, and vintage had a bit of a background moment still. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when we saw Mark I GMT's fuchsia bezels were going a little bit insane, or radial dials, like these very rarer niche variants of popular models doing really well and actually gaining in price sort of subtly while this whole modern watch thing was happening. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's over a little bit and those prices are actually slightly decreased. I mean, anything that went up in 2021 has come down. And that was a little bit of part of it, but the regular market for vintage Rolex is really always there for me. It's when it becomes on trend, when you get more calls, but there's always interest.
Interesting. So are you getting more calls now than you were 3 months ago for vintage, or is it still more contemporary focused stuff?
Versus 3 months ago, certainly.
You're getting more now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, if I'm looking at a trend and it's the start of one, maybe, or it's a blip, you know, it's up, but I wouldn't sit here and say vintage Rolex is back and it's the next thing.
Got it. Got it. Cool. Guys, thank you very much for joining me today. For everyone at home, you know, stay tuned to Hodinkee. We're going to have some coverage, I think, of some auctions, I guess, right, Tony?
I guess so.
So, you know, in the first episode, we're calling it Episode Zero with Mr. James Stacey. We said we would do an episode dedicated completely to answering your questions. So if you guys have any questions for myself, for Tony, for Rich, for anybody in the house, so to speak, email us at radio@hodinkee.com and we will give you an entire episode dedicated to answering said questions. Thank you, guys. See you next week.